Near-Death Experience Podcast, an ongoing exploration of spiritually transformative experiences, including NDEs and other phenomena, in order to elucidate the ineffable and better understand our spirituality. All episodes are available at ndepodcast.org. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and guests are not necessarily those of NDE Podcast, the NDERF, any sponsors, or for that matter, anyone else. In the end, the only opinion that really matters is yours. Near-Death Experience Podcast, item number 291, April 25th, 2020. The conclusion of Jim Bruton's NDE interview. Hello and welcome to Near-Death Experience Podcast, the official podcast and source of audio accounts for the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation, NDERF.org. I'm your host, John Messer. You are about to hear the conclusion of my two-part interview with Jim Bruton. If you haven't listened to the first part yet, you should do that before proceeding here. And I strongly recommend you read Jim's account of his NDE on his website, inbetweenproductions.com. There is a link to his page in the show notes of this episode and in the show notes for part one of the interview in item number 290. In the show notes of both episodes, you will also find Jim's contact information. And now, the conclusion of Jim Bruton's Near-Death Experience interview. Okay, so Jim, this is why I'm excited to talk with you. Your scientific knowledge, your cumulative life experiences. I want to get some insight into how someone with your scientific background and achievements comes to understand what you experienced. But first, what were your religious and spiritual beliefs as a youth?
Sure. That's a good point. All right. So as you can see from my general story, my life has been one of realizing your childhood dreams. I was interested in wildlife programs, and I would watch them religiously as a child. And at some point I said, how do I do that for a living? Now I have an Emmy for National Geographic work, and I lived in Africa. I was interested in old airplanes. Well, I built and flew them. I was interested in science fiction, so I got to invent this cool little, basically shrinking a TV truck into a backpack, and got to transmit live video from places never before possible. That was pretty cool. The other thing I haven't touched on yet was I also had this burning desire to know God. Ever since I was... probably in the cradle. I don't know where it came from, but it was always there. Well, one day my parents said, listen, enough with the questions. Just put on your suit, walk four or five houses down the street to Highlands Baptist Church in Jacksonville, Florida, and ask the minister all your questions. And I said, well, that does make sense. So I did. And that was in the summer of 69. And I walked in, but of course, the minister was very busy preparing for the sermon. And I said, well, I'll wait till afterwards. Well, after the sermon, he's busy shaking hands with a line of people out the door before they go off to Sunday lunch. I said, I'm going to have to rethink this. So I went back the next week, but he's not there. And I asked the lady in the pew next to me, I said, where is Reverend Coolidge? She goes, oh, we got rid of him. And I said, why? She said, because he married his daughter to a black man. Now, I looked at her and I thought, okay, you're insane. And if I give you the wrong look of, questioning why that's a reason, y'all are going to kill me, because I'm worried now everybody here is insane. This is just too weird. I knew this was wrong. Again, remember, 1969, Florida. It's the South. And of course, this was the cultural ocean I was raised in, but it never related to me. It just didn't stick to me at all. I just knew there's something really wrong with this reasoning. Well, here's the story. Reverend Coolidge had a daughter named Rita, Coolidge, who was a very, very popular singer back in the late 60s, early 70s. And she at the time was paired with like Kris Kristofferson, Waylon Jennings, some of the other popular kind of country like singers back then, but a very good artist in her own regard. Her slightly older sister was Priscilla, who was also a budding artist vocally. She was married to Booker T of Booker T and the MGs, who were amazing musicians. I think they opened for the Beatles one time, but I mean, I think he could play kind of any instrument and with great talent. So it was natural that two people who had a love for music might meet and might fall in love and might get married. The only problem was they were of two different races, and our little Southern church didn't like it. Okay. My mom explained all this to me when I went home and said, "What was that all about?" On that day, this was God saying to me, "All right, I, meaning God, made man. Man made religion. Now, if you walk the ways of man, and I'm glad you're asking questions about me, but if you walk the ways of man, you may come out with more questions. But if you walk with me, I will guide you. Where I do not give you answers, I will give you understanding. We're going to color outside the lines. We're going to go all kinds of places people say you shouldn't go, but that's how it's going. That's how our relationship will be." And honest truth, that has defined my spirituality since. I have a very good relationship with God, and this near-death experience, I would even put it this way. Upon my return and sharing it with some others, was a woman who's a vice president of the, I think it's called the American Psychical Society in New York, founded by William James and some others in the late 1800s, with a very serious interest as of paranormal phenomena. And she said, "On the day you flew, did you have a bad premonition about flying?" And I said, "Well, that's a perfect question coming from you." I said, "What's weird is as you ask that question, I know how I would answer that normally. That side of my mind already knows. But I have a new side of my mind based on my near-death experience, and that answer wants to come through right now. And my answer is this. For a moment, forget premonition. Imagine I had full knowledge of what was getting ready to happen on that day, my crash. Would I have had the guts to get into the cockpit anyway?" I said, "If God comes down and says, I need to drag you over here for about a week for a little one-on-one time, and we need to, make some course corrections. What price is too great to pay? And if it's God making the request, do you think you're really going to escape it anyway?" I said, "Now I can't say sitting here that I would have had the guts to get in the cockpit anyway that day, knowing what was coming. But I know what the answer should be, and at least I can ask myself that question and challenge myself for that question. And I think that for now, that much is okay."
I think that's an important point. Sometimes people wonder if we came here for a reason, how come we're not allowed to know what the reason is? And if we did, we probably wouldn't get in the plane.
Exactly. Think of all the things that have made us who we are. For example, bottom line is this. Joseph Campbell, The Hero's Journey. We don't love the heroes who are born with a silver spoon in their mouth. We love the heroes who are beat up and beat down. And the only reason they get up out of the dust after the 10th time is because no one's coming by to pick them up. They have to get up or they're going to lay there and starve. So, because we all understand struggle, we don't all understand privilege. So, when we hear of these horrible experiences that our heroes go through, we can relate 100%. And the thing is, would that hero have been the same if they did not go through those experiences, if they did not leave it all on the field, if they did not hold back? There's an old saying, when a samurai on the field of battle draws his sword and throws his scabbard away, he's now free to fight his best because he'll never need his scabbard again. There's such a beauty in that surrender, in that letting go. Basically, just fight your best. Winning or losing will take care of itself. That is that being present. That is that being in that moment of the impossible now that we should be. It's living your life with that much passion and that much abandon, no matter what you do, whether you're surfing the tallest wave in the world or whether you're a stay-at-home mom or dad, whether you're a janitor, whatever, every moment should be lived in that type of surrender.
Because we're all here for our own stories, our own heroic moments. We might think they're trivial, but they're far from trivial.
Exactly. Think about it. I met this single mom with three children and maybe not a lot of prospects. You know, a lot of people might look and say, ooh, three kids. But think of the hero's journey she was on. And she has three beautiful children as a result. What more noble purpose could she have been called to at that time?
This is why I love having a podcast. I get to talk to fascinating people like you and probe your thoughts. Okay, so let's kind of dig into this a little bit. Where you landed, there was nobody, there was nothing. It was a desolate, like you say, thousands of years, maybe in the future, where no one had been there. Mm-hmm. Were there at least animal sounds, birds, anything?
None. Plants? Absolutely. No, just a dead abandoned city and this egg and that disembodied voice. I'm pretty sure, well, let's put it this way, if I had to guess, why did it need to look like that? Well, obviously there are a lot of people who could be concerned about, well, were you standing in a vision of our future? Well, maybe, I don't know. But again, how important is that? But I can say this, that being in a place like that versus a very pleasant, beautiful place that could have had green fields, it could have had flowing rivers, it could have had waterfalls, it could have beautiful flowers, it could have had beautiful groups of loving angelic people, going to a place like I'm describing is probably a perfect place to send somebody who could be a little easily distracted, maybe ADD or something.
Let's probe into that a little bit. Because you lived through living in the jungle. You saw how animals coexist in a symbiotic relationship, including where they consume each other in order to exist.
Right.
And you also experienced war zones where I guess it could be construed that mankind is eliminating each other because they feel they need to do though in order to do so to continue to exist.
Right.
So you were in combat zones. And then you end up in this apocalyptic setting. Do you feel like that setting of your NDE has particular purpose or was intended set up for you because of your experiences?
Absolutely. Here's the thing. What I've realized is that in this world, the world we live in that we're talking in right now, we see life through the filters we want. You know, when we look in the mirror in the morning, we say, yeah, there's the most handsome or the most beautiful person. Here's the most capable person. Whatever difficulties, I'm going to challenge them and I'm going to master them or beat them. I'm going to win. You know, things like that. We tell ourselves what we need to get through the day. On the other side, we see life through the filters we need. And that can sometimes be more of the mirror we're looking in as a mirror of truth without the benefit of our ego filters. We have to sometimes see ourselves as we are, warts and all. Well, because everyone tends to report an incredibly tailor-made experience when they're over on the other side, sometimes I've wondered, are we really all having the same experience, but through our individuated filters of need? And that's why we sometimes describe it differently, because the weird thing is, after attending the first International Association of Near-Death Studies conference that I ever went to back in Labor Day last year, I realized hearing people talk about their near-death experiences and calling out different aspects of it that make each experience sound so different and so individual, I said it still... There's a part of your heart after you've had an NDE, there's a part of your heart that's hearing it saying, we're all saying the same thing. And yet, you know, if you were to listen to just the recordings, no, this person saw this, this person experienced that, they heard this music, this one, you know, whatever. But somehow there's a sameness to it all that I think is a quiet subtext to the spoken word. And I'll also say this. It was weird walking up to a conference room to go into a conference as everyone from the last conference was pouring out. Now, I knew no one at all. But everyone is looking at each other with a hint of recognition. And yet we're all strangers. And so it was the most amazing thing to suddenly find yourself, you know, on the many couches that were in the lobby talking to strangers. sometimes about, I'll say about very intimate details of your life, because we're all in the integration phase at this point, trying to cope and wrestle with the what if, what now, you know, what happens next, putting our experience into our lives, that it was just such a fascinating experience from that ancillary benefit beyond what was being said on stage or in a workshop. The breakout sessions, as I would call them, where you just suddenly find yourself talking to strangers about these experiences, really was amazing. And it's also amazing how I've remained in wonderful contact with so many of these people since. It's as if, you know, you've been rebooted to version 2.0 after a near-death experience, and now you have a new set of friends, a new sense of family, and definitely a new sense of dawning, and this is to your point earlier, dawning awareness of what you're here to do. You talked about that, about the continual discovery versus knowing the whole story right now, like what I'm here to do and where I'm going to eat today and who I'm going to meet tomorrow. I have a real sense of just how much God wants us to have that sense and experience of discovery. And here's something I think really validates it. You know, as students of comparative religion, we will read a lot of holy texts. And it's interesting for me, and maybe this can be generalized, I don't know, how some of the best, deepest, most profound truths I've ever read also had a slight ambiguity to them. And I really see this in some of the Eastern texts, like in the Tao Te Ching, sometimes like even in some of the Zen Buddhist sayings. And like when it says, you know, of course, hearing the truth should be disturbing. Or, you know, if you're afraid to die, then die now. For having died once, you'll never have to die again. And I mean, there's enough ambiguity there that you it rings of some truth, but it forces you to stretch. It forces you to reach out. It forces you to think and consider and maybe go compare with other things you've read. It's in that stretching that we start to emotionally attach to that truth and make it our own. And making it our own means individuating that truth to our own personal experience so that it does have meaning. That's that process of unfolding. That's that blossoming from a bud into a full out rose. And there's a beauty in that journey, and God doesn't want to rob us of that. And that's why when I asked him a question, I said, when I'm making these choices, I don't have a moral compass to do this with. I'm just going by pain. I said, I don't even know where or what these choices are. And I said, where is no more important than what or when? Removing your enthusiasm to further chain yourself to the world isn't as painful as carrying the crushing weight of those chains once forged around you. All right, I'm sorry. Mike, can we redo that?
Go ahead. No, that's fine. Keep going.
No, what happens is, you've heard of electronic anomalies? I have that happen all the time. And every time I talk about the in-between, Siri starts going off on my phone. I'm just going to shut it off. I apologize.
No, that's okay. I'll leave it in so people can understand. That's part of what I was going to ask you later was, do you have these kind of problems?
All the time. I've blown up my HVAC system, my microwave, light bulbs nonstop, weird communications, anomalies on my phone. It's just nonstop. I just turned my phone off. But what I wanted to get back and say, you know, that I was told that, you know, the pain of attachment is far worse than dealing with this here and now. And I said, so, you know, I don't know how comforting that is. And I said, you know, eliminating bad choices doesn't mean you won't make wrong ones. You won't know they're wrong until after they pass. And since right and wrong are variables over which you have no control, the answers to what come tomorrow are a waste. Better is understanding the beauty of how things fit and refit together. Meaning, let me show you how I've got this. And I said, so what am I missing here? I know there's so much. And it said, what is clearly before you? Grace. Said, no one deserves salvation. It can only be given by grace. It is your birthright, but it has to be chosen at the expense of the world that separates us. And I would say, if I could just say a few more things. I said it's as if this place was designed, for one purpose and one purpose only, and to the degree that I cannot screw it up. And it said, if those with choices make poor use of them, then offering fewer possibilities could be called mercy. And with that, I watched one of the gears disintegrate into dust as it passed out of view from the present into the past. And then I was told, you can't change the past, but you can make better choices in the future. Everything is interconnected, and pay more attention to your relationships. Be gentle with everyone as I am gentle with you. And I said, well, gentle, what's gentle about all this? And the final thing it said to me was, you prayed for something for which being here is the answer. And now the man who fell from the sky is not the same who flew into it. And with that, I said, I think I can live with this now. And that's when I came back.
That's you woke up again.
Yeah. And yet still have no memory for another week because, I was waking up out of a coma. But I calculate that was about right based on what everybody else said in terms of my ability to interact and how idiotic I was for that first week.
Okay, so let me ask you a couple things. I understand you may not have the answers to this. So you remember your propeller stopping, and that's it until way after you woke up from your coma. Do you think that your experience started immediately there in the crash site or way afterwards when you were in the hospital and went under anesthesia?
You're right. It's hard to say, but if I were to think out loud, many people wonder, does God in his mercy before say a terrible crash or if you were in a burning building or something like that, might he ever kind of jerk our souls out of our body before the bitter end, just like I said, again out of mercy? Well, I can't say if that's what happened to me or not, but I can certainly say I have no PTSD about my accident. I could totally build another airplane, get at it, and go fly it. And I don't have any problem with that. And also, you'll hear a lot of times when people have a near-death experience, the horrible incident that delivered them to that experience becomes more of a footnote in the story. If you didn't have the near-death experience, it might be the climax of any story. Like, and then, the truck crashed into us, or, we fell off the cliff and everybody goes, wow. And you could talk about that, and everybody would be on the edge of their seat. But when you're talking about your near-death experience, you almost have to be reminded and go, oh yeah, that's right. I did have the plane crash, but now let me tell you about the good part. And everybody's like, what? Tell us about the plane crash. Well, no, that's not the good part of the story. I really couldn't say, but my belief, because okay, a part of the story I've left out was when my family finally got to the hospital a few hours later, and I was there in the breathing machine and all that. I was very delirious. Again, physical shock, painkillers, probably some amount of anesthesia. I'm just not sure, but definitely no, not cognizant, not rational at all. And my oldest daughter was sitting there, and one part of my background I haven't talked about has to do with some very quiet work for the government and the military. You can't invent something very innovative in communications like I did, especially when it's good in remote locations, without attracting certain attention. A wonderful partnership was formed. It was always very much in the background. And my oldest daughter knows a little bit about it. And it was while we were sitting together, she said she knew where my mind was by the way I was talking to her, that I thought I was like in an enemy hospital and that they were going to torture me for information and I had to escape. And I asked her, I said, can you remove one of these restraints? Because they had me restrained because they didn't want me to pull out the tubes in my delirium. And she said, no. And she said, then I just laid back and I started to wiggle in a kind of funny way. And all of a sudden, my right hand was out of the restraint. And she called for help, and the nurses came in and they were really mad and they re-restrained me with bigger, tighter restraints. And then that's when they told my wife, we just need to put this guy in a coma because he's a handful and we've got a lot going on here for the next week. So my belief would be that it's upon putting me into a coma that, and I got very quiet here, that I was very attending on the other side. Does that make sense?
It does. I've heard you interviewed on other shows and I've read much about your experience. So I'll ask you some questions that maybe you haven't really touched on here.
Please.
When you were in the war zones, you spent time with the Marines. You became very close to them. You talked about the spiritual experiences because you had life-threatening situations. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. There are two parts to the time in Iraq that I think are interesting. Let me start with the first one. In late 1989, I had an out-of-body experience for some reason, who knows why, when I was living in Charlotte. I had a home in Charlotte. I was back and forth between there and Namibia. And in there, I saw myself in the future at some point at night getting on a military helicopter in the Middle East. That's all I knew. It was in the Middle East. And as we took off, this guy with like a turban or head wrap or something jumped up with a shoulder mounted missile and blew us out of the sky. Well, I had some awareness of, you know, what was going on and being alive after I was killed. And when I woke up, it felt like an elephant had been sitting on my chest. Well, again, that's in 89. All right. So the first Gulf War comes along a couple years later. I'm thinking, okay, somehow am I going to go over there? Am I going to wind up there? Well, that didn't happen. Okay, fine. So kind of forget about it. Well, a few years more later now, in February of 2003, by then I've been with NBC for, I don't know, 7 or 8 months. And I am being told, okay, you know, you're going to Iraq, you're going to embed with the Marine, or, you know, you're going to Iraq. You'll find out who you're embedding with over there. And what happened was we were in Kuwait at Ali al-Salim Air Base. All the news agencies had presence there. And various military branches, you know, you had the Army there, you had the Air Force, and you had the Marines. So we would see our individual names, you know, of the journalists up on the board. And the big blocks, you know, like Army and several different arrows coming out, you know, like different branches of their infantry. With the Marines, it said ground or air, and the Air Force, I don't even remember. But with the Marines, I saw my name going to the Marines. Okay, is it going to go infantry or air? It goes to air. The next day, fixed wing, meaning, you know, like a regular airplane, or rotary wing, like helicopters. It went to rotary wing, helicopters. And I looked at that and I said, I've just seen my name across several days move into the Marines, move into air, and now move into helicopters. And I remembered the vision I had getting on a helicopter in the middle of the night in the Middle East and getting blown out of the sky. I said, this is why I'm here. I've come here to die. So every night, I was in the assault on Baghdad the first night in a helicopter. One day next to us went down. Every night I got on a helicopter, whether it was you know, one type or another, and it was many flights. I got on there thinking, tonight's the night I'm dying. Tonight's the night I'm dying. Now imagine just doing that over and over and over, embracing death every night. It's not, I might die. It's like, no, I'm here to do this. It's going to happen. Well, I didn't die. And my belief is this. At the time I was living my life and saw that, I saw what was perhaps the most potential of probabilities in my future based upon how I was living my life right then. In the interim, I met this widow with three babies and now was starting to live my life for something greater than just myself. I was starting to live my life in service to others and getting ready to make huge changes in my lifestyle with regards to those others. And, you know, to go from the what we could imagine is a very exciting life of being a war correspondent and, you know, doing secret work for the military and government to now trying to live a more sedentary lifestyle to bring the wealth of that experience and knowledge to bear in raising three children who did not have a father and there wasn't one about to show up. I think in that moment, my path changed from one of, let's say, certain death to one of certain life. And as we know, I mean, our marriage vows say till death do us part. So even should for one reason or another, this marriage end, I may not have joined this to be a lifelong husband as much to be a lifelong father to these three children who are now coming of age. Okay, so that was the first experience I wanted to share. The second one was as we were rolling through Baghdad, rolling through Iraq on our way to Baghdad, I was re-embedded to an infantry division, the 1st Battalion, 4th Marines out of Camp Pendleton. And all I can say is I have love for the entire Marines. I just love them to death. They're great guys. They're like cowboys. They sleep in the dust, they eat in the saddle, and they just get it done. So hoo-ah, guys. We went into Alcoot to create a diversion so our mechanized battalion could go around. And we had two vehicles, an armored personnel carrier and an armored Humvee. We sort of parked them like nose to nose at a 90-degree angle to give us pretty good cover from the town. However, there were several high buildings behind us, and they were shooting at us. So we had cover on three sides, and we were being shot at from five. And they were really hammering us hard. While we were there, I mean, I'm hearing their machine gun rounds. They're called AK-47s. I'm hearing these AK-47 rounds hit all around us. They're clinking off the armored personnel carrier. I'm hearing the scream of mortar shrapnel going close overhead as they're mortaring us. And then I saw this rocket-propelled grenade skip by my feet. Luckily, most of the ordnance made in Iraq is a dud. Like, we estimated maybe 70%. So hopefully this one was from there. But if that had gone off, it would have taken us all out. And it was just over and over. This was going on, let's say, for about 2 hours, 2.5 hours. But what's really weird is, by all rights, I should have been scared to death, especially not having an extreme war background like some vets might. But I just felt this incredible peace, like one with God, one with the universe. And I just remember being extremely peaceful about it. And at that moment, that's when I think I made my decision about quitting the war business to be a householder, because I was said, you know, I'm standing at a crossroads right now, and the law of averages around living this type of life doesn't really bother me too much. I said, but at the same time, if I go down this road, I'm going to be able to less and less be able to relate to anybody. What become my common frames of reference in life as I give life and its events meaning? Things that people just can't relate to because they can't imagine living a life by choice of doing this. I said, so let me see what I can do to take my path of man-making back to society and continue it there. And I asked a friend, a Buddhist friend. I said, why wasn't I scared? I said, I'm not, you know, the macho guy that marches into a bar and tells war stories so that everybody will tell him he's great. I said, I'm not that guy at all. I said, but here where I should have been scared to death, I felt peaceful. And he said, I know why. I said, why? He said, because in that moment, everything is true. There is no gray. And I said, that's it. It's a moment that made us present and brought that focus of attention that brings that type of peace. In that moment, I was having a taste of what it's like to be present.
Not unlike your NDE, where you were in the moment where it's all truth. This is all you have.
Bingo. And even though it might look like a kind of a similar war type environment, if you will, or post-war environment, there was a peace, but it was even a deeper peace. It was a peace that wasn't like, oh, I have attained peace. It's more like peace of this is how you're supposed to feel here. This is what's natural for here. Even if you're uncomfortable at the time because you're dealing with you're having a taste of the pain of choices you could make. And in that split second of time, like I said, even though I could see those video feeds, they weren't sticking in my head because I guess one way of looking at it is this. As I've mentioned, when I'm present, there's no way I can watch a movie or do anything that has to do with linear time. Because here we have linear information processing. We want to do something. There's a step A, a step B, a step C, a step D, and on until we complete it. But nonlinear information processing is where we stand back from something and just watch its patterns. And it's as if that is the language of the other side, is through nonlinear information processing. Instead of getting a story where you have to, I've equated it like this. Using our computers, we can download a 2-hour movie in like 2 minutes. Well, if you look at the file, it's full of ones and zeros that mean nothing to us. But embedded within those ones and zeros and their arrangement is the amazing story that could change our lives. There's the stuff of Academy Awards. There's the technical information built into it of how to make a good movie. But we have to play it through a media player and out over a period of 2 hours in order to understand what all those ones and zeros mean to us. That's sort of in a similar way, the difference between taking in information here and taking in information there. You can get the whole enchilada all at once. Boom, done. Here, we need to sort of play it out over time so that we can integrate it into our consciousness.
And that makes so much sense with the statement you got of the answers of what comes tomorrow, not important. More important is to understand how everything fits together.
Exactly. And in coming back and continuing, as I call it, chew on the experience, which could also be called meditation, a lot of very subtle hair splitting occurs, where you start to separate things out so that you can better understand them. And for me, it was that the difference of answers and understanding. Like answers gives rise to purpose and understanding gives rise to meaning. So when people say, what's the purpose of life, which means what are the answers I need in order to give life purpose, I'm starting to think maybe you start with a different way of asking that question, that you don't say what's the purpose of life, but what's the meaning of life? Meaning being the fruit of understanding, which is again a non-linear approach to watching how the patterns of life swirl around you based upon your affinities, based upon your choices, based upon your destiny, based upon what seems to be uniquely you. And if we approach it from that angle, perhaps we'll get a better understanding. For instance, if a young, highly romantic person says, I really want to find the person I'm supposed to spend the rest of my life with, where are they? Maybe the better question to ask isn't where is the one, but how do I need to be loved? That's man, know thyself. If you know how you need to be loved, a lot of people are suddenly going to pop in focus in front of you that weren't in focus before.
So philosophical. Have you become very philosophical since your experience, more so than you were?
Well, I think I always kind of was, but the difference now is this, and I say this as humbly as I can, after kind of getting my butt kicked over there, is that what I knew before from my studies of, let's say, comparative religion or philosophy or whatever, I would say were a lot based on intellectual knowledge. Now, they're literally woven into the fabric of my being. Everything I've said today, I haven't had to refer to a scholarly text or a foreign text to draw from. It's really come from the heart.
Let me ask you some more specifics about your experience, your egg, the dimensions of the egg. How tall do you think it was?
About 4 stories high.
Wow. How large were the slots you could reach into?
The open lattice work, no, it wasn't a challenge at all. There's a picture on my website that I sort of created from some elements I found out on the internet that to me captures as closely as I can what it looked like there. I would say it was fairly open. It wasn't hard to stick my hand through, and I guess the size of the gear didn't make it too hard to pull out.
So these gears were hand size. You couldn't, did they have any mass or weight?
I would say I don't remember them having any mass or weight, but that's a good point. Maybe in a state of potential, that weight and mass hasn't yet been defined. However, I would say the most defining thing about them, and again, this is by inference, it's not by what I was told. If I were to say some, remember I said some were very definite and some were more ghost-like. I'm feeling like the ones that were more definite were the ones that were more likely to occur, and the ones that were ghost-like were perhaps less likely to occur. Again, total guess here, but in trying to guess why did things look like the way they looked from a logical perspective, that's one approach I could take.
Some people say we come here with certain experiences that we have agreed to experience, so we're definitely going to experience those. But then we always have free will, and you have options. So maybe some of the ghost-like ones were more optional, and the solid ones were, nope, you're definitely going to encounter this situation.
Possibly so. And I would certainly say that when we say we're coming here to have certain experiences, many are the ways to that experience. Some, with the illusion we have of any control over our lives, simply the timing of when we exercise our will toward one of those experiences may be coincidental with its unfolding anyway, and in a manner that makes us think that we brought it about. Whereas in another situation, we may not have done very much at all. Like, you know, if we're a waiter in a diner in Hollywood and we're discovered and suddenly we're a movie star, that's a pretty different way to get to that same experience than the person who's standing out in a line of 1,000 people just hoping to read three lines that catch the attention of the director. And yet they both could wind up on the same set just through two very, very different ways. And so when I look at my experiences, I'm thinking, gosh, how impossible were these? You know, I wanted to build an airplane and I built an airplane and flew it twice. And then I asked questions about God and I've had a very close conversation with God, and, you know, and on and on and on, you know, wanted to invent something. I got to do that. Wanted to travel. I got to do that. And all to a level that in this, as this world would measure it, was a high achievement. Each one of those could have been a lifetime achievement, but I got to do them all. And again, there's absolutely no intention of bragging about that. I consider it to have been blessed. And now my goal is how can I distill the grapes of this experience into the wine of benefit for the greatest number of people?
Let me ask you about emotions. You landed there. You felt nauseous. You felt pain. You did not feel any fear. So emotions go with us, at least in the near-death experience.
I do believe that. Here's how I've come to look at it. Okay, and think about this too. Look at our society. If I were to say to you, you're a very logical person, you would feel like, well, that's a compliment, right, John? I mean, you'd say, oh, that's a compliment. He says, I'm a very logical person. But if I say you're a very emotional person, for some reason in our society, we might take that as a slight. However, it is about balance. Logic does tell us what should be correct, but emotions tell us what's important. And that's the only justification. There are no wrong emotions to have. There may be incorrect logic, but you have a right to feel how you have a right to feel based upon so many things, some we know and some we don't know. But we always have to respect that. And again, in using that as a guide to tell us what's important, it's important to, again, have that balance in life and to make sure that we do give it equal measure as we come to any important decision. But while I was over there, it's as if I was beyond thought. It's as if I was beyond emotion. That had just gone that little bit further, because neither logic nor emotion needed to figure into, let's do what we can to remove this pain. You know, if I step on a tack, I might have an emotional reaction of, and it might come out as a four-letter word with an exclamation point, but it's not like I'm going to remove that tack and make sure the room is full of fully removed of further tacks with either logic or emotion. I'm simply saying I don't want to repeat that experience.
We talked about this briefly, but I want to go into it a little bit more. Many people who have NDEs experience a very loving experience, and yours, well, would you say that it was love-based?
I do. Like I said, with the, like using the boot camp analogy, it's not the kind of love that comes up and hugs you and wipes away your tears. It may cause, well, your interaction with it may cause tears, but that's on you, not on it. So I do see it as having been love, if for no other reason than that, so to speak, time and attention was given to me that I might become a better person from it. And nothing hurtful was said, like, you're a bad person. It was saying, you may make bad decisions. Let's work on that. It didn't say you're a bad person, but you might make bad decisions. So let's remove that so that you can become the kind of person you're meant to be. That's love.
And I know that you said you were told that you were brought there for a reason, as an answer to a prayer. Do you remember praying for something like that?
Not directly, but again, that ambiguity makes me stretch and say, what was it I asked for? Because I was told one time by a mentor of mine, for instance, when I would watch Wild Kingdom, yeah, the animal show when I was a child, and I asked one time, how do I do that for a living? And my friend, my mentor said, that was as good as a prayer. I said, I gotcha. I think at some point, as we could call it in the soul's midnight, at some point, we all go through something like that. It might be a moment of despair or a moment of loss, a moment of lack of such lack of purpose and a sense of place in the world that we do call out God's name. And there's a sincerity, there's a humility to that reaching that point that I think really gets through all the noise to God. And if our calling out is sincere and humble enough, then he calls our name. And on the day he calls our name, we're going home. Now, we might go home with our head bumping, or we might go jolly, but by God, we're going home.
Yes, as you were told, your breaths are numbered, and he decides when you'll take the last one.
Yeah, that gives me goosebumps still to hear that, because it just means that everything is okay, and everything's always going to be okay.
Amen to that. So what advice do you have for others who want to change their futures, eliminate possibilities of bad choices, certainly not going to go through what you did?
You know, I'm glad you're asking that question, because I'm already being told, you know, I've got a book getting ready to come out this month, and I'm already being told, please start writing on the second one. And of course, that usually means you're picking up where you left off. Here's the one thing, as I've meditated more on the art of letting go and how that's all the force of will I'll really ever need, and as I've seen that practiced, I compare that to our Western culture that's a little more action oriented, like, you know, go out and forge your destiny, you know, things like that. Create, you know, whatever. You know, you can fill in the blank however you want on that one, but we see plenty of examples around us of where it appears to have worked as well. And yet this approach is a little different. I'm going to contrast it. Imagine we came up with a workshop and we presented it. This is the workshop on the art of letting go, how to just let go of the things that hold you back. And here are the other awarenesses that will be the fruit of that practice. On the other hand, there may be, and again, no disparagement intended. Perhaps this is, again, where a balance like logic and emotion are needed. There will be ones on, like, for lack of a better term, prosperity consciousness, how to attract the things in your life that you want. Now, a lot of these things might be, the backdrop to a lot of those discussions may be beautiful vacation locations. They might be beautiful places to live. They might be a whole lot of really nice things in the world that it looked like you really didn't have to work hard to get to, because you just created the right space within yourself to draw them to you. Okay. Again, no disparagement, because one step in the direction toward God is one step. Even if it's a scenic route, I don't care. It gets us thinking about big things. Well, the subtle difference between those two approaches for me is this. One assumes that there's a lack. Even if you're doing okay right now, in the idea of how do I create more prosperity, how do I attract these very nice physical things with mental ancillaries that would make my life, that I think would make me happier, it means there's still a lack in me. I don't have those things. However, when you talk about the art of letting go, you're saying, listen, if you want to become happy, yes, you could go and try that path over there. And fine, go try that path over there, because you can't row in two boats at once. But if you want to try this path of letting go of things, the first thing to do is, as I've said before, if you love archery, if you love shooting your arrow, the day I offer you a gold ring, your hand starts to shake. If I offer you a chest of jewels, your hand shakes so bad you can't hit the target. Because now you're thinking about winning instead of thinking about shooting. All we need to do is stay thinking about shooting. I guarantee you, when you see a photo of this guy riding what has to be the largest monster wave in the world on a surfboard in Portugal, I mean, this thing is like a nightmare monster, and he is surfing it out. He's not thinking about winning a trophy. He's not thinking about the fame and the fortune that could come from doing such a thing. He just needs to stay on that board, and it's a moment-by-moment thing That is being present. You can't pull that off without being present. So my philosophy around the art of letting go is that you already have everything you need. Think about it. You hold a baby. And except I would say in rare situations, this baby has everything, and that generation of babies has everything that is needed to take care of all the problems in our world. This baby does not know avarice. This baby does not know war. This baby does not know greed or lust or any of the other vices. This baby is very present. And so, you know, when we're told, you know, be more childlike, well, there's a case in point right there. You can walk outside usually and see it anytime. But to start with the fact that we already have it within us, and that our practice should be in the removal of obstacles in our path, many of which we have ourselves placed there, again, based on past choices, that is what it is to let go. That is what it is to focus on the moment. That is what it is to not focus on winning or worry about losing. It's just to focus on the art of living. To me, that is the fruit of what I've brought back. And if you can be in that space, then I think it makes it a lot easier to avoid the bad decisions. We may still make wrong ones, meaning we may make mistakes, but our intention is the big differentiator there. And even in the East, when they talk about karma, whether it's good or bad, it's the intention more than the action itself that creates karma. If you could act in a way without intention, without expectation, without attachment, you could act in a way that does not generate karma that binds you here, whether it's gold chains or iron chains.
It's the old Yogi Berra saying of, what do you think about when you're hitting a baseball? I can't think and hit a baseball at the same time.
It's so true. This guy was like totally tapped into something. It is so true. And even, you know, in a very, one of the classic simple ways of living a very Zen life is only do one thing at a time. And honestly, I've wondered about that. And I saw something really interesting the other day that said, a lot of people who have, we'll go beyond just saying near-death experiences. We'll just call them in a greater umbrella and more inclusive one, spiritually transformative experiences. And I do think that's a preferable term. That when people have these STEs, a lot of times they start to wonder, where's my memory going? I know I'm not suffering from anything debilitating, but what's happening to my memory? This is, it's because you're no longer needing your memory to tell you what you know. You're moving more into the moment and living by intuition, which will tell you what you need to know and when you need to know it. And when you no longer need to know it, you're able to let go and again be back in the present. I'm hearing this, I'm seeing it, and I'm living it. I really do think that with everything else going on in our world right now, there are some very interesting, very quiet transformations going on that could greatly benefit us all.
I do think that's the path.
And it's time. It's time.
You've listened to others talk about their NDEs and SDEs. You've been to conferences. I know you listen to podcasts. What do you think about will lie ahead when you don't go to the near-death experience, when you do cross over and you're going to stay there?
Well, in that what I saw and what I experienced, I think was, again, very tailor-made for me. And I think it was also very much in that moment. It's exactly what I needed at that specific time. I wouldn't be surprised if the moment I left it, that place just dissolved back into what it was before. My belief is that there are other planes of existence between the earth plane, and we'll call it the highest, most unmanifest heaven plane, and that each one of these planes, as you go toward heaven, become more beautiful, more angelic, more holy. You living in each one of those planes also become more purified, if you will. So all I can say is that hopefully whatever I have to do here with the life left to me will take me to the highest plane possible, and that I can probably detox from this place for a little while and then fully absorb what I have there in order to either return here if I'm directed to, or to move on further toward the highest form of God. So I tend to think in terms of it as process more than content, in terms of what I would be doing there, the continual evolution practice versus what it might look like. Because I think we all, from like you say, all the near-death experiences we hear about, it can look like so many things. But what's important is the work we do is one that increases our relationship with God. And that's the only thing God wants. That's all I understand that God wants, and that's he just wants to have a relationship with us. One thing I have thought about is that, you know, if we can certainly say this is true across the board, the earth plane of life is really all about intensity. I mean, there's a reason these other planes are called the sublime. And it's almost like, you know, I sort of use this analogy. Imagine your soul just cruising through the universe. You sort of whiz by this blue marble and you whip back around and you're sitting there looking at it saying, what's that all about? Imagine someone said, well, that's Earth. Well, what's Earth all about? Well, that's where you go to have some intense experiences. So far, we've sort of described what Disney World is to someone driving by on the highway. You know, what's that? Well, that's where you go to have intense re-experiences from your happiest childhood memories or something like that. You know, oh, well, maybe we should go check that out. And think about it. From a state that has not yet incarnated to Earth, what does race or gender or wealth or sickness or war mean? Nothing. So one choice will almost appear to be as good as another. Like, do you want to come back as black or white? I don't care. Man or woman? I don't care. I just want to go see what it's all about. Okay, fine. And, you know, here's an open slot. Go. The next thing you know, you are born either into a life of privilege or a life of suffering or somewhere in between. And then because this place is so intense, it's easy to forget the sublime, to forget our spiritual nature. And so we start to get wound around the axle of all sorts of things here. And one of the best analogies I ever heard is that, as we were talking about before, when you cry out to God, like, get me out of here, take me home, you know, like, this place isn't fixable. You know, we're not going to fix the dying. We're not going to fix the poor. We're not going to fix war. It's always been here, always will be. The only thing we can do is focus on getting out. At that moment, it's like, consider our souls as a beautiful, fine silk scarf. Yet it's wound very tightly and knotted up in a big thorn bush. And what whips it, the winds that whip it further into the thorn bush are the winds of our desires and the winds of our fears, the winds of our bad choices. And so God will, as much as we may be impatient, like, God, take me home right now, that would be like God taking that silk scarf and just ripping it out of the thorn bush, tearing it up. But he says, no, I'm not going to tear it up. I'm going to lift it out one thorn at a time. And that may take more than one lifetime. But once I start, I'm not stopping until it's done. And that is our journey home, is the lifting out of that beautiful silk scarf one thorn at a time as our attachments fall away.
Which brings up the question of reincarnation. What do you think about the likelihood of reincarnation?
I believe in it. I've had a memory or two from the past that I would attribute to reincarnation. And to me, it's just not really too big a deal whether you believe in it or not. I don't think there are any mortal faults to be suffered by believing it one way or the other. I do believe that either way, the truth will be self-evident. Just as God doesn't really care. God wants to have a relationship with us, but if we're intent on not believing in God, he'll just say, well, fine. You know, again, the truth will be self-evident one day, and then we'll pick up where we're leaving off right now. And I think it's the same with reincarnation. I think it becomes a much easier way to explain so many things that we experience or that we think about or that could seem like logical extensions from any starting point of thought. I do understand how a lot of people might have a problem with it. And again, I don't think it's anything we have to really get hung up around or say as a point of division. I think we can simply say whether we reincarnate here or whether it's work we carry on a different plane that we go to, it's the work we need to focus on, not the where that we're focusing on it. Does that help?
It makes a lot of sense. I think that religions are hung up on it, but not people who are spiritual.
True. I mean, again, like God told me, man made religion and God made man. So which do you want to have a relationship with?
What kind of things do you practice to build your spirituality? Do you meditate? Have you listened to the Hemisync recordings? Are you familiar with that?
I am. Back in the mid 1980s, I first heard of Robert Monroe and what the work he was doing. And I had a woman friend who was dying of terrible melanoma, and actually gave her those books because I found comfort in them. I'm not sure if she ever read them or not, but again, the truth of it all became self-evident to her in time. And I have a, what I love about the whole Hemisync thing and Robert Monroe's, I mean, he was an engineer. So he approached this thing with a certain, I'll say healthy scientific skepticism, and yet with the desire to explore it and discover it further. So I think there is so much about his approach that we could find a lot of benefit from and continue to.
Similarly, Eben Alexander has Sacred Acoustics, and he's the neurosurgeon who had an NDE.
Correct.
And so he kind of puts his own spin on it. Are you familiar with that? Can you compare, contrast, or do you use these devices?
Right. I am familiar with his work in this regard. And also Mary Helen Hensley has been working on a lot of sound frequencies that can do things like, you know, whether it's for healing or for insight or meditation and things like that. I mean, I think on multiple fronts now, we're discovering how sound and deeper than sound, vibration and frequencies themselves are important elements in our environment to incorporate that are exactly the two, just like we go play golf. We have a certain golf club we use for a certain hole or a certain place on the golf course. And I think the frequencies are like that too. What work do I need to focus on today? Maybe if I've had something that made me angry or frustrated me or disturbed me, maybe I need to have one type of frequency playing today. If it's, no, I'm feeling pretty chill, I just want to sit here and meditate on nothing, maybe there's a different frequency you might use for that. So I think it's all part of, again, discovering what tools have what effects on us and being very familiar with them and then surrounding ourselves with them and then sharing our experiences with others so they too can benefit. For me, what I do, my meditation's a little different. I do sometimes sit and meditate, but honestly, and I know this sounds weird and a lot of people might say that's not very environmentally friendly, I can't speak to everyone's concerns, it's when I'm driving. When I go driving, it's just God and me. And I live in a beautiful part of the country out here in Connecticut in the countryside. I have a lot of farmland and cornfields and forests I can drive through. And I just, this is where God and I commune. I will say this, like many, if not most people who have these experiences, wake up in the middle of the night, you know, 2, 3 a.m. and just awake. Now, I will say this that further, that when I wake up, sometimes it's very apparent to me I've been somewhere else, somewhere I'm not really remembering clearly, but I can tell by the way I'm seeing things, the way I'm perceiving reality, that I've been somewhere else. You know, like I've opened my eyes at night and I've seen stars on our ceiling several nights in a row. Okay, I'm obviously still got I have a foot somewhere else. experiences being present and that like no memory kind of thing I've had happen before, usually at those times. If I were to sit and reach out, don't laugh, reach out on my phone and just sort of text some NDE friends, I might say, who's awake? Like everybody's awake, and we might start texting each other. But I find just having come out of that space, if I'm like, say I was writing a part in my book about something, that's when my best writing is right when I'm fresh over from the other side with its aura, its radiation, its aroma, whatever you want to call it, still fresh on me. That's when my writing is at its best. My mind is still, my mind is quiet, and it just flows through. And truly, it's all about kind of getting out of the way and letting it flow through. That is the art of letting go. That, to me, is how you would heal, is you get yourself out of the flow, it comes through you, and it fills the room and simply does what needs doing.
I think a lot of people experience that when they get out into nature. You drive there, many people will go camping or go for a nature walk, and that's when they reconnect.
Exactly. And think about it. Most of these experiences are, because I thought about this too when I was out there. Remember I said being on the sand dune 300 miles from anybody. It's really cool to go to a place, to stand there, and to be able to turn around and do a full 360 and see nothing that was made by the hand of man.
That's just cool. As God said to you, I made you and man made religion, God made the earth and man made all the distractions from the natural earth.
And so I think when people want to camp or people want to go on a drive out in the country or people just want to go out and be alone for a while, I think it's God calling. It's home calling to us. And we're listening and we're answering in our own way right then.
Now, we heard Siri interrupt you earlier. Many times people will have these STEs and then they end up having gifts or things that they bring back with them, abilities or powers, although they're not always positive. What other things have you experienced since your STE?
I can take you to that answer, but let me just go right to the end right now. If you were to say, you know, what got tuned up in my life after my near-death experience, maybe even amped up a little bit, yeah, you will hear about this and you'll see it. I have some very close, very real, down-to-earth NDE friends who don't even talk about, if you want to call them the gifts or the tune-ups they received, but you know, whether they are foresight, insight, healing, whatever. It's totally real and totally true. But they don't want to identify themselves with that too much. They don't want to be distracted by the rest of the world over these things. These are simply, it's like the aroma of a rose, you know, the rose can be beautiful to look at. It can also be beautiful in its fragrance, but you don't necessarily have to buy them to enjoy the fragrance. So it is with these people in there and how they manage them. Mine was empathy. And it started in the hospital. My nurse, I had three shifts of nurses. And the morning team was the A team, absolutely without fail. And one of them was named Jen. I don't remember her last name. And she left the hospital shortly after I was discharged. But she was just amazing. And I noticed one day, it just seemed like as busy as they were, she would just sort of hang back in the room because she just liked to talk about life, and, as I call it, life, the universe, and everything. And she's the first one I talked to about my NDE because it was just going on and on in my head. And I was like, what is this thing? And I said, am I really already dead? And being in a hospital is this mental construct I've created in order to come to grips with it. And hey, who's in a hurry? Let the guy come to it at his own speed. And I told her that. And I said, but I have this other thought that's been going on in my head. And I described to her the experience you've heard now about being in the in-between and what it looked like and what was going on. And then she started crying. And I said, why are you crying? And she said, I don't want you to die. And I said, well, you're a nurse in a hospital. You see the death all the time. She said, no, but you're magical. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, you know how busy all the doctors are? I said, yeah. She goes, every patient here gets maybe 15 minutes of their doctor's attention every day. For some reason, I'll look in here, I'll see 3 to 5 doctors. They're all in here for an hour, hour and a half. I snoop. I walk by. I'm listening. You're not talking about your medical records or your case. You're talking about all sorts of things. This one doctor wants you to go into business with him and has you on international conference calls, you know, laid on your back with your leg up in a cage, doped up on all kinds of things. She said, I've never seen anything like that before. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I definitely felt a sense of connection to everyone. And it seemed to be reciprocal. I just thought, you know, this is how they treat everybody. But again, you know, I was not all with it either. But I've had amazing empathy experiences or empathy experiences happen. I've walked into the very, very busy Port Authority in New York City where all the buses come through in and all the subways go through. And I wanted to have a cup of coffee. There was a line like 30, 35 people long. And I'm standing in line to get my coffee. And this person behind the counter, for some reason, just walked out, walked down the line, walked right up to me and said, what do you want? And I told him, and they brought it back, gave it to me, no charge. And I had a friend with me. He goes, what was that all about? I said, nah, maybe oh, you saw me on TV or something, you know. Just over and over, this thing of empathy. I would also like to just comment on how synchronicities are reported to be more the norm than the exception after a near-death experience. And I had a most beautiful one just a few weeks ago I'd like to share. As spring comes into our homes, we all start thinking about, you know, sprucing up things or projects that we put off because it was winter or whatever. Well, some of our window screens after a time needed to be repaired. So I called the local glass company. They came out. They were looking at some windows in general, but as they took some of my screens away. Then they called me the next day to say, your screens are ready. So I got to their shop. It was like 4:30 on a Friday. And as I'm waiting for them, it's a husband-wife company. As we were waiting for the wife to get off the phone and give me my invoice, I was talking to her husband. And for some reason, you know, when you have a near-death experience, sometimes if you have 5 minutes with somebody, somehow it just, in a weird way, can come up. And so I started talking about it. But he was really interested. And then his wife hung up. She's really interested. And of course, I always give people an out. I say, I know this sounds crazy. No, no, tell us more. Okay, fine. So as I'm sharing it, and you're going to love this, how this story ends. She asked me, she said, so tell me, after your experience, were you more intuitive? Like, could you like tell the future and stuff like that? I said, no, it's not really like that. I said, and again, this goes right back to when God said, everything is interconnected and pay more attention to your relationships. It's as if he was really waking that affinity up within me. I said to her, I said, the magic is really more about relationships. And amazing timing. Like I don't have to read the future to not be in a certain place because something's going to happen. Circumstances will just occur to prevent me from being there. Or things like that. It's like, I don't need to know. I just have to trust. At that very moment, at 5 o'clock on a Friday, their daughter walks into the store. We all look up at her. She looks at them. She looks at me. And she goes, I remember you. Found out that 3 years and 4 months before, she was the upper thoracic nurse who was treating my ruptured lungs in the hospital after my crash, in which I looked very different than the way I was looking in the store right then. And when she said that, I just looked back to the mother. And I said, that's the answer to your question. That's what I just said. It's all about the relationships and it's all about the crazy timing. I said, what were the chances of this right now? And I said, the beautiful thing about this is this. If you'd asked, do you have more intuition? And I basically, you know, said what was going to happen in 5 minutes, like your daughter's going to walk through the door. That would have been proof of a sort of gifts. But in a way, I would have owned that moment because that would have been like showing off. I said, but look at what just happened in this moment when she walked in and validated my answer to your question. We all get to own this moment and its magic. It doesn't belong to any one of us. I said, that tells me right there the source of what comes to me now. It's good enough.
So important to remember that it's not about us. It's about God.
No, and it is so cool when something magical really happens that people just can't put together, but no one can own it either. It just right. came of its own because it was perfectly set up to do that. That I love. I love. I love. I love.
We all need to look for more of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We should. And we should ask for it. And it's just like the difference of being out there surfing a wave all by yourself or being out there surfing a wave with other people. Imagine being out there with people and you didn't know them, but there's a way in which you all move that intimates a synergy, a way of almost like working together somehow. It's just really cool. It just makes you feel connected in such a beautiful way.
Tell us some more about your upcoming book. What are you going to call it?
What else? The In-Between. I thought Perfect. About calling it, Catch and Release or Back by Popular Demand. I'm just teasing. But I did call it The In-Between, A Journey of a Lifetime.
Yeah, tell us all about it, how we can get it, if we can pre-order it. Or...
Sure. Yeah, the book is called The In-Between, A Journey of a Lifetime. I wrote it in 3 months. I came back from the international conference over Labor Day with a stern talking to from PMH Atwater, with whom I've become good friends. And she and Mary Helen Hensley, another prominent person in the NDE world, both were saying, "You've got to write a book." I said, "Well, I'm kind of interested, coming from a visual background more, and maybe writing something for television or film." And they said, "Start with the book. You can just build that right off your presentation," which everyone loved. I said, "Okay, fine." So I came back, and basically from September 1st to December 1st, I wrote the manuscript, and Mary Helen connected me to her agent and publisher, Lisa Hagen and Beth Wareham, and they read enough of my story to take me in and guide me and work with me, edit it, and now it's gone back to the book designer in its final version. So the goal is to have the book available this month. In there, I talk more certainly about my background that led up to the day I was building and flying airplanes. I recount the near-death experience and conversation I had. And then the last part of the book, I'd say really, like I said before, it's an effort to distill the experience into some type of actionable intelligence or usable wisdom for people. And that certainly, as I mentioned before, when people are sitting and talking during the conference, it's part of the integration. It's part of the how does this fit into my life and what do I do now? And certainly a lot of that is how do the people in my life who didn't have the experience, how are they going to fit it into their life as well? So that's always a bit of a challenge. But it, like I said, it'll be out. I believe it will be available on Amazon. It's Lisa Hagen Books, I believe. But I believe you'd be able to order it off her website. But again, all I can say is stay tuned over this month of April and look for it. You can always type my name into a search. I'll put everything out on Facebook or on inbetweenproductions.com website once it's available. I'll certainly let you know, and we'll see what people think. Hopefully it's something people can relate to. Hopefully it's something that will lift people up even an inch that they can use, and we'll go from there. And then we'll see. And based on the feedback from the first book, that will help guide me into articulating a possible second book.
I'm looking forward to it. Please do keep me informed. I will put links in the show notes, folks. If they're not there yet, it's because
Thank
you're listening to it before it's available. But when he tells me, I'll back it up and put links in the show notes. Okay, so give us your contact information if we want to learn more about you. How do we find out?
Please, and I welcome anyone to reach out anytime, any way they want. My website for my experience is www. inbetweenproductions.com, and that's productions with an S on the end. Inbetweenproductions.com, and you can go there and read my site. There's a little button that says contact. You can always reach out to me through there if you like. You can directly reach me by email. I'll say it and then spell it: geonav1 at yahoo.com, and it's GEON as in November, AV as in Victor, and then the number one at yahoo.com.
Jim Bruton, I thank you so much for your time. Such a fascinating conversation. We have to talk again when your book comes out.
John, I look forward to it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate our time today. One thing I've realized is you might make up for lost sleep, you might make up for lost money, but you'll never make up for lost time. So anytime someone gives you their time, it's truly, truly a gift. So thank you. And thank you to your listeners as well.
We'll talk again. Namaste.
Namaste. I see the light in you. Bye.
Look in the show notes on the ndepodcast.org website for links to everything we discussed in Jim's interview, including his contact information and how to purchase his book, The In-Between: A Trip of a Lifetime. Some synchronicities to ruminate on before I close this episode. We're trying to elucidate the ineffable. Jim gives us some insight into why that is difficult and gives us some pointers to help us understand the broader perspective. On the other side, information processing is nonlinear. So many times we've heard NDEers say, Everything happens all at once over there. Jim points out that here we have to integrate the superpositions of what might happen, what is likely to happen, and what actually did happen into our consciousness. This is our basic consciousness in this world. We have to accept that our consciousness after this existence will be vastly different from our consciousness while we are here. We just can't possibly understand everything about our existence after this life. Not yet. By examining STEs, we just might get a little better understanding and expand our consciousness now. That disembodied voice that Jim feels was God told Jim, "No one deserves salvation. It can only be given by grace. It is our birthright, but it must be chosen at the expense of the world that separates us. Salvation must be chosen. This makes sense, as our Creator gave us free will. But we must choose salvation at the expense of the world that separates us from our Creator." What is this world that the disembodied voice told Jim separates us? The earth? I don't believe so. The earth is a temporary home. Compared to eternity, our time here is so brief, it's... well, our time here could be analogous to Jim's in-between. Perhaps, from the perspective of eternity, the span of our brief lives here is our impossible now between our past and our future. After all, every moment is the process of becoming. And for all we know, our pasts may stretch out for longer than our mortal existence. Who knows? But that doesn't matter because we can't change our pasts. And the answers of what comes tomorrow are a waste. Answers give rise to purpose. Understanding gives rise to meaning. It's better to understand the beauty of how things fit together and refit together. God's plan. Our salvation must be chosen at the expense of the world that separates us from our Creator. The expense of our plans. Our incredible, ineffable Creator's plan must be chosen at the expense of our plans. If those with choices make poor use of them, then offering fewer possibilities could be called mercy. Fewer choices. Mercy. Synchronicities. How many times in your life have you felt that something didn't manifest the way you wanted it to, the way you prayed and begged God for it to happen? That loss, that failure to get what you thought you so desperately needed, may have been mercy bestowed upon you by our Creator. Conversely, when it comes to a beautiful life-altering experience, one that you wanted to happen, and it did come to fruition, how many times have you noticed how everything that had to happen did happen? Everything. The sun comes up tomorrow, the flowers in the spring, a baby being born. How many things had to continuously happen perfectly for everything to exist? Things that you or I couldn't possibly ever control. God's plan. I love how Jim tells us at the core of all NDEs, it really is the same. Though the reports can seem so vastly different, that inexactness, that ambiguity, really is the same message. Love. Thanks again to Jim Bruton for sharing his amazing experience and life story with us. Thank you, Chaz, for letting me be part of this podcast. Thank you for listening and supporting us. It means so much to Chaz and I to get your feedback and your comments. Until next time, this is your host, John Messer, reminding you, it is all about attitude and gratitude. And our attitudes must surely be love.